Once again, a pleasant good morning to each of you. Glad that you're here. If you have your Bibles, turn to the book of 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel. And while you're getting settled, let me put this up here. You realize in just 2 weeks, Brother Cantrell's going to be here and talking about finding our purpose from the past. I've actually heard this much of this series before back in Indiana, and I'm telling you, you guys are in for a treat. I can't wait to hear it again. Andy's a very capable speaker, and he has such a servant heart, and you're going to enjoy. If you haven't met him already, you're going to really enjoy getting to know him. Hope you'll carve that time out, just a Sunday through Wednesday, 5 sessions total, maybe more than that if we can get him to maybe have a Devo or two. Anyway, hope you can be here, October 9th through 12th. I'm so excited about that. Okay, 2 Samuel. We've been reading a lot about David this quarter. Hope you've been able to do the Bible reading. Hope you've been strengthened through that exercise. One of the purposes, look, of that is just simply to help encourage us to have and to maintain the daily habit of being in the Word. So if you haven't availed yourself of that opportunity, really would encourage you. And hey, we've got a great, you know, renew yourself to reading moment coming up. Quarter four's about to begin and the schedules are out there. So nothing stopping you from grabbing multiple copies of that. We'll print more if we need them. If you want one in every Bible so you don't, you know, leave it in one Bible and then not have it when you need it. Pick up several of those and make use of those and hope that's a blessing to you. Our theme for the fourth quarter in that reading is Rejoice in the Lord. Well, my family and I have really gotten a lot out of reading this quarter through the life of David and the Psalms that he wrote. I wish we had time to go around and ask, what is your favorite David story? There are a lot of them to choose from. Maybe you would say, well, I really like the story before the story, like the book of Ruth. That's kind of part of the story of David. That's a great part of the story. The slaying of the giant, obviously. I expect we'd have several that would mention that. The story of his friendship with Jonathan. That is a tremendous part of David's story. Or the stories of his great military victories and what God accomplished through him. The story of Abigail and Nabal. That's a great part of the story. And yes, even what we talked about last week, maybe you would say, yes, his sins were awful, but the story of his confession and renewal after sinning greatly, that's a story we all need to hear, isn't it? Because we all will travel that pathway. Maybe the story of his zeal. I'll tell you, as we were ending, we're about to end our reading of David, it's so impressive to me that after God said, you can't build the temple, he didn't pout. He said, all right, I'll do the next best thing. I'll do everything in my power to help the person who will. Of course, that would be Solomon. That's a great part of David's story. I don't know what your favorite David story is. I do want to mention, though, today what one of my favorites is, and it's in 2 Samuel chapter 9. So 2 Samuel chapter 9, where we're introduced to Mephibosheth. And if I call him just M, at points of this lesson, if I have trouble pronouncing that, I may just revert to that, okay? So you'll forgive me in advance. Mephibosheth. I'll tell you, one of the greatest acts of grace in all of the Bible is found here in 2 Samuel chapter 9. Of course, Jonathan made David promise him that he would show his household kindness after he was gone. And of course, when David was king, and that's exactly what we find here in 2 Samuel 9. He finds a son of Jonathan named Mephibosheth, whom verse 4 says was crippled in both feet, unable to care for himself. And he comes to David, of course, completely helpless, utterly defenseless before the king. And most men in David's spot would have done what? They would have killed him because of who he was and what he represented as a potential threat to the throne. Instead, David does two things. Not only does he show him mercy by not killing him. He goes beyond that and blesses him far beyond what he expected. He shows him tremendous grace in verses 7 through 10. Mephibosheth was given life. Mephibosheth was given an inheritance, provisions, and yes, a place, think about this, at the king's table. What must that have been like every day? To dine at a table you don't deserve to be at. Oh, I think we can connect with that thought, can't we? What foreshadowing this story provides. That's one of my favorite David stories. This morning, I want to talk with you about what happened next. Someone says, what do you mean? Well, there is a next with regard to Mephibosheth. There is more to the story. And I was reminded of that recently as our family was reading through the book of 2 Samuel. And it really struck me, and I thought about it for quite a while. And I'll tell you this morning, as you think about this with me, I'm confident that the more you think about this story, the more you're going to go from maybe feeling down about part of the story to just feeling encouraged and uplifted. And I hope that that's what this lesson provides for you. The rest of Mephibosheth's story, that's what I want to talk about this morning. That's not the title of our story, of our lesson. You'll get the title later. But I want to talk about the rest of the story because I think what we're going to see in this is basically this point, and I believe it's a profound one, and that is the appreciation that Mephibosheth had about the grace he had been shown. There's no doubt that he was shown great grace. I think this part of the story then gives us some insight as to how Mephibosheth felt about that, how he thought about that, and indeed how he behaved as a product of what he thought about that. So I want to share that with you very simply this morning. Of course, the big question all of us need to be asking is, of course, do you appreciate really the grace that you have been shown, that I have been shown? So let's get into this, and we're going to set the stage ever so briefly. We're gonna fly through some chapters here of 2 Samuel, and we're not going to spend very long because you know what they talk about. Right after this, chapter 9, you don't go very far until you see that in the years that followed, David's great extension or expression of grace toward Mephibosheth, trouble came to the nation. Chapters 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, David's sin with Bathsheba, the subsequent murder of her husband, brought great shame and reproach upon Israel. And then, of course, David's family began to just fall apart. And we talked about that, alluded to that at least last week. And eventually his own son attempted to overthrow his dad and seize the throne. That's how dark it got. And David was forced to flee Jerusalem, taking his entire household along, okay? So we're going to let up on the fast forward button, and I want you to zoom in on that scene. Get that picture of David and his family and his servants and so forth leaving, fleeing for their lives, and we zoom in now, we hit play, and zoom in now on chapter 16 of the book of 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 16, David is on the run. And lo and behold, we're going to find Mephibosheth coming back into the story. Verses 1 through 4, let's start with a reading of that. Verse 1 of 2 Samuel 16. When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 of summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" Ziba answered, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink." And the king said, "And where is your master's son?" Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem, for he said, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father.'" Then the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." And Ziba said, "I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king." You see what's going on here? Shortly after leaving the city, and we've already established kind of the frame. Can you imagine the frame of mind David's in? And all of the thoughts he has going through his mind as his sons trying to usurp the throne. And all of the flood of emotions that's just coursing through David. And he happens to meet the man he assigned to serve Mephibosheth named Ziba. And I'm going to tell you, it was no accident that this was the timing of Ziba's meeting David. Ziba chose his moment well. You see, Ziba was not the kind of person you would actually want working for you. Not if you want someone who's loyal. Ziba was an opportunist who ultimately was loyal to himself. And he thought of a way to rid himself of his obligations toward Mephibosheth without angering the king. And at the same time, coming out of all of this, smelling like the rose, like a rose. So what does he do? Well, the first thing is he butters up the king, maybe quite literally. And then he fabricates this false, what we're going to see ultimately is a false accusation against Mephibosheth. What he says, and you don't have to, this isn't do we know or do we not. We're going to see this wasn't true. He accuses him of having this desire to see David brought to an end and his father's house to once again ascend to the throne. That was far from any desire that Mephibosheth had. This was a false accusation concocted by this man Ziba. And I'll tell you what, it worked. He chose his moment well. It worked because David was consumed. I mean, think about this. David is here consumed by Absalom's coup, naturally. And then here comes Ziba, and what does he bring? Oh, some of the comforts of home, right? And for those that, I mean, can you imagine the sigh of the people with weary legs that says, oh, animals to ride on, and summer fruit, and sustenance of all sorts, the comforts of home. So Ziba chose his moment well, and he was able effectively to deceive David into believing that he was on his side and that he was motivated by nothing more than loyalty to him. And then he was, furthermore, was ready for David's questions. For example, why aren't you attending to your duties concerning your master's son, Mephibosheth? And he had that covered too. He was ready with his accusation. Well, you know, he paints him in the darkest possible light, accuses him of insurrection and treason, which, I mean, think about it. David just gobbled that up. Because think about it. If your son is capable of doing the things that he was doing at that time, was it really that far-fetched to think that a descendant of Saul would be capable of similar things? You see, Ziba chose his moment well. And so to David, here's a guy that seems to be one of the few. We're starving to find somebody who's on our side, who's in our corner. And so he rewards, David does, what he perceives to be loyalty on Ziba's part. And then Ziba completes the deception so masterfully in verse 4 by heaping praise on the king. What a scoundrel. What an absolute scoundrel, which I think may be an insult to scoundrels. I'm guessing Ziba, and I wouldn't be dogmatic about this, I'm guessing he reasoned that David would never have a chance to uncover the truth of the deception. And maybe the thinking went along this lines. Maybe, well, maybe he wouldn't wouldn't figure it out because he wouldn't be around anymore. Maybe Absalom would take the throne. And of course, what is he going to do to Mephibosheth? Well, he has no loyalty at all to Mephibosheth. He has no obligation to keep him alive. He'd probably kill Mephibosheth. And so that all works out great for Ziba. He's got the goods, and all the people that would know anything about it are dead. But of course, that didn't happen. Absalom was killed, and David was actually able to return to Jerusalem, and finally, Mephibosheth got to meet him. Now, apparently, word had gotten back to Mephibosheth about what his servant Ziba had done. And so we skip down to verse 24 of chapter 19, 2 Samuel chapter 19. Chapter 19 and verse 24, and let's read two or three verses here. It says, "And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul," so Absalom's dead and now David's been able to come back to the city. That's where we're at. "And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king." Now notice, "He had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety." What's that a picture of? That's a picture of mourning, the king's absence. So David's going to start to clue in, oh, what was said about Mephibosheth wasn't true. Verse 25, "And when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, 'Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?' He answered, 'My lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said to him, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go with the king, for your servant is lame. He has slandered your servant to my lord, the king.'" We'll stop right there. The truth was that Mephibosheth wanted to ride to meet David himself. He obviously couldn't do that easily because he was lame. Evidently, he commanded Ziba to do it, but instead, what does Ziba do? He hatches his own plan, goes to see David himself, and throws Mephibosheth under the bus, as we say today. Now, here's what, for me, just speaking for myself, is something I struggle with when I read this story. This is, for me, maybe the worst part of the story in verses 29 and 30. There's this exchange, there's this conversation, but the bottom line, so okay, what's going to be done about this? Mephibosheth has been defrauded. "And the king said to him, 'Why speak any more of your affairs? I have decided you and Ziba shall divide the land.'" You and Ziba shall divide the land. Did you get that? David only gave him back half of what was stolen from him. Would you be good with that? I mean, put yourself in Mephibosheth's place. I want to tell you what, if this had happened in America, I don't see Brother Holloway, but I'm going to tell you there'd be a lot of people like Phil. I see Kristen. There'd be a lot of people like Phil getting phone calls if this happened in America. I'm just going to be very plain about it. A lot of attorneys, but this is a monarchy. David's word is final. There are no appeals. Injustice has taken place, and Ziba seems to have gotten away with it somewhat, and Mephibosheth is powerless. He was powerless before, but he's still powerless. So that's, I don't know about you, but I struggle with that part of the story. But here's where we go from the worst part of this story to the best part. In fact, you really can't have one without the other, as you're going to see. Because when we read the response of Mephibosheth, we're going to find a man who is completely content. He's good. And I want you to be, I mean, we should be amazed by that. We should want to imitate that. Remember the question I asked you to think about? How much do we really appreciate the grace that has been shown to us. Mephibosheth is completely at peace, as we're going to see, and someone might ask, how can that be? I believe it was because after being wronged, we see a triumphant grace. A triumphant grace. Mephibosheth truly appreciated the grace that had been shown to him. Grace triumphed over injustice. It wasn't that he didn't think he had been wronged. It wasn't that he didn't feel strongly about that. I have to believe it was very hurtful to him that Ziba did what he did. And yet the grace that had been shown to him won out in his heart. It won the battle in his heart. And so very briefly, I'd like to talk about some of the layers to that. And we're not going to go terribly deep, but I think all of us need to really reflect on this in our own lives and make some applications, some very prayerful applications. So I want us to think about this concept of triumphant grace. And I want us to see how this plays out in the life of Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, grace won in the heart of Mephibosheth, and I want to point that out in at least three ways. First, I think we see in his attitude grace, a triumphant grace, in that he maintained his humility. When Mephibosheth first appeared before David early on, I'm thinking back chapter 9, he certainly had a humble attitude then. He recognized the grace that had been shown to him was truly, as we, by definition, we would say, truly undeserved. If you go back to chapter 9 quickly and verse 8, Mephibosheth paid homage and said, "What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?" You see, he's humble in heart. But then we see here, even years later, he's eaten at the king's table. He's enjoyed all of these blessings. His humility has not left him. And even as he's being wronged, he remains just as humble and just as convinced of the truth of himself. Remember what Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." That describes Mephibosheth. Look at chapter 19 again, verses 27 and 28. Mephibosheth speaking says, "He, Ziba, has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like the angel of God. Do therefore what seems good to you. For all my father's house were but men doomed to death before my lord the king, but you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I then to cry to the king?" You notice that? All my father's house were but men doomed to death. I was sentenced to die. We obviously can see the gospel implications there. I had a death sentence, and you raised me up and seated me at your table. Wow. I'm going to tell you, reading that ought to humble us. It ought to stir all of us to, at those times when we need it, and I sure need it, to get over ourselves. Have I forgotten my own wretchedness? Without the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, if I was defrauded today out of everything that I owned, would I have this attitude? When I am wrong, do I stand ready to forgive, or do I feel rather entitled to hold a grudge until further notice? And when others seek to help me to overcome sin, how do I respond? You see, there are some ways to measure, do I have this kind of humility? I will say to us, it is a mark of spiritual maturity to have this kind of humility, because the Christian who continually seeks to grow into Christ is the one able to remember his wretchedness, the fact that he was saved from an awful fate, versus the Christian who forgets. Peter speaks of that in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verses 5 through 9. Where he says, "For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control, and self-control with steadfastness, and steadfastness with godliness, and godliness with brotherly affection, and brotherly affection with love. For if these qualities are yours and are increasing, they keep you from being ineffective or unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ." Verse 9, "For whoever lacks these qualities is so near-sighted that he's blind, having forgotten that he was cleansed from his former sins." Grace is triumphant when we remember. Grace is triumphant in the heart of the humble. We see grace victorious on another level in his focus. We see a man indeed who had learned that ever elusive quality of contentment. Contentment with his blessings. For Mephibosheth, contentment was certainly achieved. He didn't allow his own difficulties to blind him to the blessings he did have. In fact, as we go back to 2 Samuel 19 and we see that if David were to take everything away, if the worst happened, Mephibosheth wasn't kidding. He really would have been, believe it or not, okay with that. Look at it. Verse 20, 29, "The king said to him, 'Why speak any more of your affairs? I've decided you and Ziba shall divide the land.' And Mephibosheth said to the king, 'Oh, let him take it all.'" You think he was serious about that? I do. "Let him take it all. Why? Since my lord, the king, has come safely home." He was just thankful to be alive. He was thankful to have a place at the king's table and to see David safely back home and once again being honored as king. The grace that King David had shown to him had brought him great blessings that he couldn't have otherwise had. And he says, "I'm good." That's triumphant grace. And there's a real key there, isn't there, to developing contentment in the heart. It has to do with how we perceive the blessings we do have. Let me ask us, how big is the blessing of salvation to us now versus the day when we obeyed the gospel? I mean, seriously, the day, and I know I've talked about this lately, I don't mind bringing it up again. The day I entered into Christ, as the song says, "Oh, happy day." Has that become old hat with me? Old news, I want something new to click on. Is that how I look at that? Contentment comes when we discipline ourselves to raise our appreciation for the blessings we already have. How about 1 Thessalonians chapter 5? Verse 16, "Rejoice always. Pray without ceasing. Give thanks in all circumstances. For this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you." We also see grace victorious in the heart of Mephibosheth when we examine his priorities. Now you'll notice these three points really overlap heavily. That's okay. We're just trying to examine this, draw it out, think deeply about it, because that's the pathway to making important applications, is to do that sort of meditating on the text. Mephibosheth didn't elevate his own personal problems and difficulties above the much greater crisis taking place at the time. There were some big things going on, and Mephibosheth understood that. Chapter 19 of our text, verse 24, Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. He'd neither taken care of his feet nor trimmed his beard. We read that. Mephibosheth understood. He had been in mourning about that. In verse 30, as we read a moment ago, that was Mephibosheth's priority, to see the king come safely home. His concerns were, in his mind, truly secondary or tertiary, somewhere further down the list. Keep in mind, he had a legitimate case against his servant. He had truth on his side. He had been the victim of injustice. Surely, if there's a place for righteous anger to burn, it's here. Who wants to take up his case, right? And yet, what matters the most to him? The glory of the king. Did you hear that? The glory of the king. We can shoot an arrow from that point to applications in our heart, can't we? Grace proved triumphant in his heart, and that his priorities were impacted positively. He sought the greater good. By the way, that is teaching you'll find throughout the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 6. There were Christians taking one another to court. In fact, Paul says in that text, why not rather be defrauded? Really fits with our study, doesn't it? Because you see, there's a greater good. In the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, Jesus says, love your enemies. Why? Because there is a greater good. There's God's vision of what He wants us to become, the way He wants us to live as His sons and daughters. He wants us to reflect His grace and mercy. There are times when, as Christians, we must choose to forego what we perceive to be our rights for the greater good of the kingdom. I think that is an ongoing battle that we need to preach on continually, especially in churches in America. There are times when we don't understand why God allows certain things to happen. And I say to us that it's in those moments when grace must triumph in our hearts as well, when we must be willing to admit the limits of our understanding, press on into the unknown, in the conviction that God ultimately has a good purpose that will be accomplished. You've been very kind listeners, but I want to close with this very important question. And all of this, each of us must ask himself or herself, has God's grace won me over? Has God's grace won you over? All of us are Mephibosheth. I'm Mephibosheth. You're Mephibosheth. As Hebrews chapter 12 reminded Christians, we have an altar that we offer at, that others don't have a right to offer at. We eat at a table that we don't deserve to be at. Do I appreciate the grace that God has shown me? God's grace is best expressed in the person of Jesus Christ, who died for us. We didn't deserve that. He was risen from the dead in the hope that we too could be raised as we enter into Christ to newness of life. Is there someone here that needs to be baptized into Christ today? You need to think about, what has my response been to the grace that God has shown me? I'm not asking just what you think about it. I'm asking, what have you done about it? And Andy will talk a lot more about that. As it occurs to me, I phrased that a certain way. He's going to preach about who is Jesus to you and what have you done about it. That's an important question that we need to consider again and again. We're going to sing a song to encourage you to make your life right with God, if we can help you in rendering service to God, getting right with God. We'd love to do that. Won't you come now as William leads us in this next song? Let's stand.